Good afternoon. The time is 2 o'clock. Welcome to Vox Pop for this Thursday, October 11th. I'm Ray Graff. Time once again for another Science Forum on Vox Pop. And we welcome back our trio of experts to answer your questions. The number to call is 800-348-2551, 800-348-2551. Or you can email the program at voxpop@wamc.org. Do you have a scientific question that is bothering you? Well, even if you don't, we'll be bothering you coming up right after the news. Hello once again. Welcome back to Vox Pop, WAMC's live afternoon call-in talk show. I'm Ray Graff. Today we reconvene the Science Forum. The experts are here. They came through the rain, and they made it just in the nick of time. If you have a scientific question you want to pose, the number is 800-348-2551. 1-800-348-2551. You may also email us at voxpop@wamc.org. But again, our number, 800-348-2551. This is the fun part. Let's have our team of experts sign in, please.
Oh, goody. I get to go first.
Yes.
Oh, it's Barbara Brabets. I'm a biochemist from SUNY Cobleskill.
How are things going at SUNY Cobleskill?
Pretty good. It's been tough for our county, but we'll, you know, that's not science related.
Yeah, I tell you what.
I'm Jim Pickett. I'm an organic chemist and an editor of journals and books.
And how's that going for you?
Well, I was talking to Ed. Karma came back and got me, you know, a paper that I submitted got a pretty snarky review, but
oh, rats.
I'll get them back.
Karma.
We'll be
karma.
Talking about it during the show.
And our,
but I'm not bitter or anything.
No, that's fine. We're used to that in Studio A. Bitterness is our middle name. Ed, you can introduce yourself.
I might as well. Ed Stander, SUNY Cobleskill as well, geology, astronomy, environmental science, anything anybody else can answer. And I was wondering, how long is a nick?
A nick of time.
You said a nick of time. How long is a nick?
That's a great scientific question. I don't have the answer to that on hand.
There's a show you could call for that.
It's about 10 to the minus 2 jiffies, I think.
10 to the minus 2 jiffies. Okay, well, I guess we'll just go right to the phones then. Arthur and Pauling. Arthur, you're on.
Yes. The water that is picked up by hurricanes and deposited on land, if the hurricane is over the ocean, is the water saline? And does it therefore get deposited on the land and to become part of the rivers and streams and increase the salinity of the rivers and streams?
Well, that's a great question. Certainly very timely this time of year. It's actually both. There are components of hurricanes that bring fresh water ashore, and then there are components of hurricanes that bring salt water to shore. So if you think of it as two different events, you've got the evaporation to make the clouds, right? Just like the really bad thunderstorm part of the hurricane that's going counterclockwise in that kind of dish. Those clouds are depositing fresh water because they're from evaporation. And so when water evaporates from the ocean, the salt is left behind and the fresh water condenses in the clouds and becomes precipitation. But the other piece is that the wind and the storm surge both push all that salt water into shore where it normally isn't. And of course, the wind is a big factor. And so that salt water spray from the wind does impact the ecosystem considerably and does transport salt water to freshwater sources. After Hurricane Katrina, a lot of the freshwater marshes that are in that Gulf of Mexico area were severely impacted because of salt poisoning. So the plants that were not salt tolerant died. And therefore, they lost a lot of the ecological benefit of those marshes, making it even more susceptible to water surge if there were a future hurricane.
Well, that takes care of that now, doesn't it?
Thanks, Arthur. We appreciate it.
Always the good news.
Here's a question. It's a fun one. Hurricanes contain an awful lot of water. Do you know how many elephants' worth of water a hurricane contains?
Gosh. They told me swimming pools at the last, during Hurricane Florence, I heard something about Olympic-sized swimming pools. It was like 73 trillion Olympic-sized swimming pools.
That's a lot of pools.
So how many elephants fit in a pool?
The weight of a hurricane is on the order of 2.5 billion elephants.
Wow.
So they're flying over your head. Just think about that.
Amazing.
With debris also.
Oh, exactly.
Right.
Think about what's coming down.
Yeah.
I have a hard time with flying elephants
myself. What an amazing
myself.
Amount of energy that gets released when a hurricane hits. So you have this one today, Michael, That's kind of booking at a pretty adolescent speed of like 15 miles per hour, pretty fast compared to Florence, which hit about a month ago. And still, the place looks like a bomb went off because it was a weather bomb, this weather bomb that continues to explode and explode and explode with a little less energy as it progresses across the Carolinas. It's amazing how much energy has to go against all the other factors that dissipate energy in our society, in our science
environment,
and get it to kind of concentrate all into one little bundle of joy.
And then once it's over land, the friction slows it down. And
the friction of that counterclockwise rotation and moving against the non-lubricated surface of land slows it and kind of breaks it apart.
And of course, there's less energy because you're losing the energy of the water. So that slows it down. My real question is, where do the elephants go?
I think they end up in the landfill along with everyone's refrigerators and mattresses. Yeah.
But it's really the evaporation of water over the ocean that's the engine that winds up the hurricane.
That's why one that sits in position on the coast is potentially
it's
more
awful.
Dangerous.
Yeah.
Feeding the elephant.
Yeah.
Yeah.
This is the Science Forum on Vox Pop. The number is 800-348-2551. Barbara Brabets, Jim Pickett, and Ed Stander are here to answer your questions. We go to Rick in Pittsfield. Rick.
Hey, good afternoon. How are you?
Good.
Quick question. I have a couple regular old radios in my house, and when I walk room to room, they are actually broadcasting at different rates, giving a delay, and it's pretty noticeable between the different radios in terms of picking up and delivering the signal.
The same frequency?
Same station, just different radios in the house, and one will be significantly ahead or behind the other depending what room I'm walking into.
Right.
And they're not digital, right?
Or anything
these
like that.
These
they're
are
all just picking up.
Good old analog dial it in, or are they digital?
They're old analog radios. They're just a regular radio with an antenna sticking up.
Right. And what's probably happening, we've had this question before, and we got it wrong the first time. But basically, I think what's happening is that they're slightly off signal. And so what you're getting is more than one station coming through. We get that a lot. For example, in Cobleskill, we have two stations which are quite near each other. And if you turn just a little bit to one or the other, you get the same signal from AMC, but it's slightly off.
In time?
In time. Oh, yeah.
I believe they're through to the same signal. It's the same station, but I guess you're saying there might be fractionally off, huh?
Right. Well, we get, for example, we get Albany in Cobleskill, and we also get Canajoharie.
Yep. And Oneonta.
And the three signals, because they're being transmitted, they're not sending the transmission at exactly the same time. There's always a break between the three of them.
Some are actually on a significant delay, like a 2-second delay.
Yeah. And I believe that.
Yeah, that's what I'm talking about. It's pretty sizable.
Yeah, well, that's probably what's happening.
I'll hear the back end of the same story that I just heard because I walked to another room.
Now, wait a minute. Are you sure that, though, you're on the same frequency on both?
Absolutely.
Because, 90.3 is the flagship station, but 90.1 is one of the other broadcasting channels, so it could be that little bit. And you said it's a regular dial, not a digital dial. See, the digital dial.
It's got a digital dial. It'll read out that it's a 90.3.
Well, it occurs to me, and I'm not an expert in this, but I believe there may be at play on the same frequency in spots in Massachusetts. Sort of, they're not quite repeaters, but they're expanders on the same frequency, and
Oh my gosh, we're gonna have to get Zach in here.
Yeah, but that wouldn't work either.
Don't wake him up, boy.
No, if it was expanders or something like that, then you'd be getting two frequencies on the same station rather than just going from room to room, getting a different speed.
But there is a digital component to this, and that there may be a delay involved with that.
I've seen something similar to this in that I have in my new fancy-dancy 2016 car HD radio.
Yeah, and I think that has something to
and
do
that
with
going
that.
Going from FM to HD, it'll go if the HD signal is it requires a much better signal.
Right.
So the car's radio is programmed stupidly to switch back and forth and from HD to FM, and so it ends up being like it's not really in between either one.
Now, of course, Rick says his are old-fashioned radios with an analog dial and antennas.
Some were digital.
Yeah, no, some are digital.
Oh, really?
Some are, they're not that old, but it's not like high tech. It's not like, you know, it's not like they're picking up a series or something. You know, these are 15-year-old radios or whatever they are.
Yeah, well,
not HD.
My guess is if you looked at you looked at the stations, you'd find there's a repeater station around with approximately the same frequency.
Well, thank you, Rick. That's a good one. I like that call a lot. Appreciate it. Our number here is 800-348-2551. It's the Science Forum, 800-348-2551. Barbara Brabets, Jim Pickett, and Ed Stander are here. We'll take a break. It's Vox Pop on WAMC. Ray Graff here, Science Forum, and we got this email here from Kathy who says, I believe a nick of time is slightly less than two shakes of a lamb's tail. However, it happens just before the targeted moment, not after. You see? This one came in from Jamie. What substance came together to make the Big Bang occur? Could that substance still exist in the form of dark matter? Maybe not all the Big Bang stuff went bang.
It might not be substance either.
Well, yeah. And the real problem is that physics stops at the Big Bang. So there is no scientific answer for where it came from.
Mm.
It just... Yeah, that's time zero.
It's like Grandpa was trying to play with the smartphone and take a video of the birthday candles getting blown out, and he doesn't get it figured out until the presents get unwrapped. Nice. So birthday candles never happened on Grandpa's phone. We don't have any evidence of it.
Some people have suggested that what happens is that there's more than one universe, for example, and that one universe effectively bleeds into the other universe, and that could cause it. That's how, you know, I mean, if you have enough drugs or take enough alcohol, then anything's possible.
Well, that's wisdom in itself. Thank you, Ed.
You're welcome. On the very teeny tiny scale, things pop in and out of existence all the time.
Yes, yep. The quantum thing.
Yes, the quantum thing.
Yes.
And I don't know, to keep my head wrapped around it, I think of it as the quantum thing on the really big quantum scale. Yeah.
All right. We're really having a great time here on the Science Forum. Jim Pickett, Ed Stander, Barbara Brabets are here to answer your questions. And now we go to Richard in Albany. Richard.
Hello. I have a question. The IPCC came out today and said we shouldn't cross a 2-degree Celsius threshold on global warming. We're at 1.1. It was my understanding that we are essentially at 2 degrees Celsius anyway for two reasons. One is that if there are a lot of particulates out there from coal fire that if we stop and it would instantaneously kind of heat up the earth. And the second thing is that there's a lot of baked in warmth, meaning that it takes a while for carbon dioxide to actually create its full warmth on global warming. So I would like for you to discuss that if you could, and I will listen on the radio, okay?
Thank you, Richard. It's a shame you missed our show a couple of days ago on climate change, but go ahead. Barbara, you go first.
Well, climate change is real. I think there's a couple songs to that effect by They Might Be Giants. The issue is predicting the future. It's always a gamble. I mean, you look at our weather reporting. I thought this weekend was going to be 70, and now it's going to be 55, and we're 2 days off. So predictability is always an issue, and there's uncertainty there. But some things are certain. We understand the impact to our climate by the release of global greenhouse gases. The biggest ones that we play with are really three. We play with carbon dioxide. We play with water, which actually has a global greenhouse gas rating of 1. We kind of set that by the standard. It's about 40 for carbon dioxide. And then another one is methane, natural gas, which we do produce, but also it is stored in a lot of different environments in our planet. And if it were released, it would affect the global cycle even more. The issue is what will cause a cascade of other events. So I see people dying to get in here and talk about this some more. You two want to talk about the predicting the future?
Well, I can talk a little bit about the particulates. I think at least some of the effect of the particulates diminishing has already occurred as burning of fossil fuels got cleaner. So some of the jump in temperature that occurred in the 70s and 80s was probably actually due to cleaning up the air some, and that kind of latent warming took place then, just as the caller suggested. How much more of that will happen, I'm not sure how much of that's baked
this,
in now.
This albedo effect, the effect of magnification, there are some issues. For example, as we industrialize, we pave more roads. As we pave more roads, we put less dirt into the atmosphere, particulates from like riding on a country road that's dirt. So there are offsetting pieces of all of this that are going to change it that really people wouldn't think, oh, I'm going to pave a road, it's going to affect global warming. But it will. We just have to be able to model it well.
Yeah.
Go ahead. It's been shown, for example, back in the 1970s, during a lunar eclipse, for example, the moon would effectively go black because light from the sun passing through the atmosphere would get totally absorbed by particulate matter. And what's happening now is as the lunar eclipse occurs, the light goes through the Earth's atmosphere and actually turns the moon red. And the reason for the red is because there's a lot less particulate matter. So we're pretty well cleared with that. Another thing that one has to consider is the fact that the oceans can still suck up an awful lot of CO2, and they do. During the 1960s, for example, during the big blackout across the United States, they went up with helicopters and measured the amount of CO2 in the atmosphere, and just over a 1 or 2 day period, it plummeted because the CO2 is being absorbed by the oceans.
And we weren't making any.
Exactly, right. The two of them together. So it doesn't take that much to get things to actually get cold.
All right, let's go to Tim in Boston Spa. Tim, you're on.
Yeah, actually, I have a little bit of two things. First of all, as I pull up to my front door listening to the radio, all of a sudden I lose WAMC. And I can pulse forward about 1 foot, and it comes back, and that happens consistently. Mm-hmm. And also coming down through Boston Spa, there's a little section there where it goes away.
Yeah.
But then I have another question. A Cleve Cussler movie once talked about solid anhydrous methane or something down deep in the ocean under great pressure.
Yes, the class
rates. Mm-hmm. Is there such a thing?
Yes, there is. There's about 2 gigatons of clathrates at the bottom of the ocean, mostly produced by bacterial decomposition of things washing off the land. And if it ever were to get into the atmosphere, we would be in big trouble. In fact, some people think that the biggest extinction of all time, the Permian extinction, was caused by a similar clathrate eruption from the bottom of the ocean.
Oh. That would not be good.
Yeah, it's like shaking the bottle of Pepsi and all the bubbles come out all at once. Only these bubbles would be full of methane and probably catch on fire and we'd all burn up.
It gets better than that. The methane in the atmosphere interacts with light from the sun and breaks down into CO2. It takes oxygen out of the atmosphere. Okay. So what would happen is not only would we have global warming, but we wouldn't have any oxygen to breathe.
So it would not be a good situation.
Not at all.
It'd be a time to sell your stock.
As far as the radio goes, Tim, I think this is a handheld radio you have?
No, it's a car. David Gillespie years ago explained it to me, but that was years ago. I'm 72 years old now.
Well, I mean, it should get better as the foliage leaves us. You'll have better signal. But, I mean, there are things in between our transmitter and your car, basically.
Yeah. I found this consistently down in Albany some places.
Yep, that'll happen, man.
I'm going to stop like.
Yep.
Bingo.
That happens all the time. You could get a better antenna or a better receiver or
There's some Wi-Fi interference too that happens. When I pull into Stewart's to get gas, they must have transmitters that go from the pumps to the main console there inside that are Wi-Fi, because almost always I lose whatever signal.
Yeah.
Doesn't matter what channel it is.
Getting an overload
just blowing through my radio spectrum.
Our number here is 800-348-2551. It's the Science Forum. Barbara Brabets, Jim Pickett, and Ed Stander here. And the number is 800-348-2551. David in Albany. David, you're on.
Yeah, listen. When when you want to turn pages or count pieces of paper, you wet your fingers and your fingers get less slippery. But in every other instance, you know, tile floors, roads, sidewalks, watermelon pits, water makes things more slippery. What accounts for the difference?
Your fingerprints.
What?
What? Everybody heard that? Yeah?
Yeah.
Okay. It was a little bit of crickets
it,
there.
Yeah.
So your fingerprints are like little mini suction cups. They're ridges that go in and out and in and out and in and out. When you lick it, you separate them out and allow that moisture to be kind of colligative, to make things stick together. When you're too wet, like dripping wet fingers, all of those ridges are filled in full of water, and then you get the slippery effect with your fingers.
Yeah.
So a little bit allows it to stick because it allows a definition of those ridges and valleys on your fingers to hold things.
Yep.
But once they're too full, then you're going down the slippery slide.
Yeah, you can think about it. Water is actually a very sticky molecule. And if you have a very thin layer of water, it all kind of sticks together.
Yeah.
But then if you've got a thick layer of water, then the fact that you have this flowing thing in the middle allows the friction to go down.
Okay.
But on a molecular level, water makes things stick together. Look at wet sand, for example.
Oh, yeah.
There you have the sand particles are close and just a thin film of water holds it together.
Yeah, there's another thing as well from the geology side, and that sometimes they use clays in paper, for example, and some of those clays are bentonitic, and bentonite clays actually absorb water. So sometimes it's actually sticky simply because it's actually taking water off your fingers and sticking it on.
Okay. Well, is that good for you, David?
Yeah, thanks a lot.
Thanks for the call. It's the Science Forum on WAMC. 800-348-2551 is the telephone number. You know, Jesse King, our intern, and Zach Malloy, our engineer, have been working on the phones, and we didn't think we'd have the phones when we just lost our last caller, but they got it back because they're very good at what they do. Let's go to Siobhan in North Adams. Siobhan, you're on.
Hi. I was wondering if you could go into further detail about how women are smarter because our brains are more complex considering we can make babies. If you guys could expand on that into simpler terms for people.
Anecdotally, I can say you're 100% right.
I'm afraid only Barbara can do
that.
I'm
in a room full of men.
I got a house full of women, and I can tell you you're dead on correct.
That's for sure.
I think this is a loaded question. I'm wondering, you know, this women are smarter thing, it's kind of one of those listicles that's like dying, the clickbait on social media that's like, if you swear a lot, you're smarter than the rest of folks. And then, you know, you click and then like, okay, she swears a lot, check. You know, women are smarter because, oh, she's a woman, check. Right. So there are a couple of things that scientifically we can talk about.
Okay.
Women, here I am on a radio show.
Yeah.
Women are better conversationalists than men because their verbal centers of their brains, regardless of all other things being equal, are better developed. So it seems it's not that we're born that way. It seems that they grow better that way. If you think that men grow muscles easier with less physical activity and that it takes a lot more physical activity for women to grow muscles, kind of the muscle of the brain and the linguistics part of that is more easily developed in women than it is men. So you can think evolutionarily of why that could be. It could be because we're the nurturers, we're the birthers, we're going to have children. Those children are going to need to learn language, and language skills are going to come from mama. I mean, how are we all programmed to talk baby talk to babies?
Yeah.
It doesn't matter. You could take somebody off the street and show them a baby, and they're going to talk like a baby to the baby. So that's in there. The intelligence. Some of the stuff like high school, where you look at valedictorians and more valedictorians are women than men now. I don't want to say that we're not all brilliant, but it could just be emotional development of youth. I don't want to make any assumptions here, but I think I see some smiles of recognition among the men in the room that maybe at 17 they weren't really concentrating on things that would make them valedictorians?
Or 27.
Yeah, that happens in China. In China, in eighth grade, you take a test that decides whether you go to college or you plant rice in rice fields.
Eighth grade's such a terrible age.
Exactly. And what happens as a result of that is an enormous number of women wind up in college and an enormous number of men are planting rice.
Siobhan, what do you think about this?
I just wanted to a little bit further some facts on it. I know my husband has a saying, actually, that if you take a group of men and you get war and you take a group of women and you have a conference, which is very true, apparently. So I just wanted to get more facts on the yes overall. And yes, I actually, the baby talk thing, I always discourage that because that's not how we talk as human beings. We talk as human beings. So that's how I always taught my children how to talk as well.
You know, there's some interesting, it sounds like you really enjoy
babies,
this stuff.
I would say no. I would say no, that's not how we talk, actually. That's not real language.
Go ahead, Barbara.
There are some great studies that are being done. I talked about them, I think, 3 months ago about functional MRI. So what we do is we do a magnetic resonance imaging of the brain, like a little helmet that you put on, and you take it and you look at the brain as it's working. So you present something, and they presented somebody a video of somebody talking to a baby in normal speak, and then they watched the baby brain kind of light up in its areas, and then they took the baby and had them talk baby talk to the baby, and the baby lit up like you wouldn't believe. Huh. So there really is something to baby talk.
Maybe it's in the pitch. Oh, the sing-song quality.
I think it's just trying to distinguish all of what is very complex sound. Mm. Yeah. If you can simplify it, then it helps them distinguish.
Well, Siobhan, that was a great call. Thank you very much. Yes. Our number here is 800-348-2551, 800-348-2551. It's the Science Forum, and your chance to call is coming up. We'll take a quick break here, and we'll be back with Jim Pickett, Ed Stander, and Barbara Brabets in a moment. James Brown for you here on Vox Pop. 800-348-2551 is the telephone number. It's the Science Forum. Ray Graff with you. And we all, what scientists we have today. Let's see. Jim Pickett is here. Ed Stander is here. Barbara Brabets is here. And Sue wrote in via email at voxpop@wamc.org. The subject heading, health problems from cell towers. Hello. I have read that living close to a cell tower can cause a variety of diseases, including cancer, heart disease, and neurological disorders. Can you discuss the health effects of living close to a 5G cell tower, and how close does a person need to live to be affected, or how far away do they need to live not to be affected?
Go on, Barb.
Well, I don't know 5G, what is different between 5G and 4G. I don't know if the wavelength has changed at all, but cell towers work on microwave radiation. So microwaves are a little bit more energetic than radio waves and not as energetic as what you or I would consider heat. So,
well, they are radio waves.
Yeah, they are. They're 800 to 900 megahertz.
Yes, but
mostly.
They're in a portion of radio that's very specific. It's in the higher energy part of radio. Go ahead.
No.
No?
Well,
I have a no. Okay.
But pretty much the only thing that electromagnetic radiation in these frequencies can do is to heat things up. And that has to do with the intensity. So the intensity of the microwaves is very high in a microwave oven and heats things up. The intensity of the microwaves out here where broadcasting is taking place is very, very low. So if it doesn't heat it up, it can't do any, there's no chemistry that can be done.
Now, other frequencies besides microwaves can heat things up and cause, I mean, I remember like the 10 meter band, which is about 30 megahertz, is one that you want to make sure your power is at a reasonable level. 2 meters, 144 megahertz, same thing.
Well, pretty much anything in the electromagnetic radiation, if it can be absorbed, it will generate heat. When you have short wavelength electromagnetic radiation, say ultraviolet rays or X-rays or gamma rays, then you can do chemistry, and then you could cause diseases and stuff.
Right.
But
typical bond breaking requires ultraviolet that we would call really low, short wavelength ultraviolet. So even tanning beds, although I'm not a big fan of tanning beds, but even today's tanning beds born purchased in the United States don't put out that type of radiation.
Yeah. But, certainly when you get down to wavelengths that are longer than the infrared, which we're talking about with anything having to do with radio or broadcast, there's just not enough energy there to do anything other than heat things up if the intensity is really high.
Right. It's like rubbing your two hands together and making friction.
Yeah,
that's really the only means of making heat.
You've got telephones, cellular phones, which are effectively talking to the cellular towers, and they're right next to your ears, and there's been enormous number of studies to see whether that effect has any effect on you, and effectively, so far, nothing's been shown.
I mean, it is all about duty cycle, too. So if you're right next to a tower,
you'd have to be living in the parabola of the cell disk.
It's funny. My father, in the 50s or early 60s, he worked for State Ed, and they were putting up the microwave links for TV.
Yeah.
And did I ever tell you this?
No.
So when they were setting up the links, at times they would take a hot dog on a stick and literally hold it up
in the parabola.
And they would cook the darn thing.
Yep.
Pretty impressive. He was ahead of his time, he was. Let's go to Michael in Massachusetts. Michael, you're on.
Yeah, I wanted to ask a question about the sound of water. For instance, sometimes when I like to brush my teeth with hot water, and when I turn the faucet on, there's a little wait there before the water turns hot. And if I'm doing something else, I can always tell when the water turns hot because it sounds different when it's going down the drain.
Cool.
Same thing when I'm pouring out, like if I have a pot of boiling water, like cooked pasta or something, I'll pour that down the drain. It has a much different sound than if I pour a pot of cold water down the drain. What is that?
My guess would be,
but
part of it having to do with the viscosity of the water, how runny it is. The cold water will be less runny than the warm water, so that the way that it sloshes around will be different.
Also,
the speed of sound will be different in the water.
Also, the cold water versus hot water. Cold water has a lot more air in it than warm water does. And that can have an effect because as you release the pressure of it, you'll actually get bubbles forming.
That's how I can tell when my shower head is ready, because the tinging of my shower head changes because there's less air in the line when it's got the hot water coming out. And then there's the other piece is if you have metal pipes in your drains, then they're going to get warm quickly from the warm water and their density will slightly change.
Mm-hmm. All right. Well, thanks, Michael.
Thank you so much.
Appreciate the call. Speaking of cooling and heating liquids, I have a bottle of a Boodle's gin in my freezer. And when it's room temperature, it flows very nicely. And it won't freeze in the freezer, but it gets very thick and viscous. Why does that happen with gin?
The sugar.
Really?
I would guess it's the sugar in the water. The sugar in the gin.
I'm trying to think.
Jeez.
Ethanol.
Is there much sugar in?
There's quite a bit of sugar in
it. It doesn't taste too sweet to me. It's a nice dry martini.
Mm, there you go.
There's some proteins in it, though.
Huh.
I mean, gin is juniper. I would think that the proteins could be kind of glomming together and making that thickness. Hmm. That's really interesting. I taste
homework?
An experiment.
Why
here.
Don't you do some homework?
Yeah, extensive experimentation.
Little hygrometer going
remember,
on.
Remember, no more than two martinis per experiment, though.
That's
yeah.
going to take a long time, then.
All right, let's go to Ted in Shelburne, Vermont. Ted, you're on.
Yes, hi, thanks. I appreciate the fine points of everything. and the question, well, one funny little observation, which I don't need to measure, but it really sort of irks me that if I'm heating up something on my gas flame on the stove, it, of course, makes a layer of water so that I'm having to boil off that water or transmit heat through it until I get a dry bit of pan to warm my whatever I'm warming from a cold state in. And this is more of a small person kitchen than a large chef with a great big fire and too many things to do. That's just a little observation also. But in thinking of, I live close to the almost Great Lake Champlain. And, of course, it's has its problems, especially in the shallow places with algae and so forth. And people never, I mean, you talk about the phosphorus and the nitrogen maybe, and but the temperature is never mentioned. And a temperature is, I mean, a set of understandings based on 10 years ago temperatures is different than what we will be dealing with 10 years from now. And I just think, I don't know if there's any, if you have any quantitative sense of it. And like I also noticed by a river, not the lake, but a big car lot, which didn't used to be there in the old days. And I think when that, and this is more of a summer than winter, but when on a hot day and you get a fast rain, there is a tremendous amount of hot metal cars on blacktop gushing hot water more or less into a river.
That's true.
So anyhow, I'm just interested in that sort of a measurement of how important that is. Or of course everything is variable, but the temperature at which, and of course it's the biggest problems are the shallow areas of the lake,
the shallow ones,
warm
and the
algae
clear
grows
ones.
And so forth. Yeah. Anyhow, that's the kickoff.
Okay, very good. Thanks, Ted. We appreciate it.
So the thermal pollution is certainly an issue. In the Northeast, we have been blessed with not having to deal with it much, and places like Texas, Oklahoma, Florida, Georgia really have. First, of course, there are biological considerations, like you take the amount of oxygen that can be in water, and it's determined by many things, but probably the biggest fluctuation is temperature. So more oxygen can be dissolved in water if the water's colder, and less oxygen can be dissolved if the water's warmer. And it's a significant change. If you think of, like, just after spring thaw, you could have a number of 12 for the oxygen. And then if you get it up to a temperature like what the Gulf of Mexico is right now, which is about 90, 89, then what you're looking at is 2 or 3. So we go from a high of 12 down to 2 or 3. And then who's breathing in that water? What can grow in the water if there is no oxygen? Those are all big considerations. Probably the largest one in Champlain, along with our general climate, is zebra mussels. They clean up the water and allow the sunlight to penetrate deeper in the column of water, and so they heat up the lake more.
And actually, the hotter it is, of course, the more bacterial action there is, which makes it even worse. So you start off with a 2 or 3, and you wind up killing your fish.
Yeah, it's very common in late fall, actually. Just about now, when things start to cool down, there's photosynthesis stops, which puts out oxygen, but the bacteria keep on going, and then it will crash the oxygen, and you'll get fish kills right before ice out, or ice in, rather.
Let's go to Chris in Gloversville. Chris, you're on.
Hi. I'm going along the same line of questions here about the properties of water. I was just wondering, what are the physical properties of water that make it so that it dissolves less gas?
For most things, as you heat them up, the gas solubility goes down. And it's hard to say exactly what it is that causes that, other than the fact that the what's called the vapor pressure of the liquid itself gets higher and higher. Eventually, as you heat something up, when you reach the boiling point, the vapor pressure is equal to the atmospheric pressure, and then you really can't dissolve anything other than itself in terms of gases.
Right. In fact, the way we get gas out of water, for example, is to boil it for long periods of time, and that makes all of the gases escape, and we end up with purified water.
So it's a matter of the molecular motion. I guess you could think of it in terms of the molecular motion chasing out the other molecules.
Right.
And there's another part of it as well, is that in order for the gas to exsolve, in order for it to come out, it has to effectively form bubbles. And in order to do that, it forms on particles in the water. And if the water is hot, then the little bubbles that start to form break up almost immediately, and they don't ever become bigger bubbles. So it never comes out. It never exsolves.
Chris, thank you very much. It's the Science Forum on Vox Pop. 800-348-2551 is the telephone number. Jim Pickett, Barbara Brabitz, and Ed Stender are here. Ray Graff, your humble host. And now we go to Gerald in Ulster Park. Gerald.
Hi. Yes, I just wanted to comment on your talking about microwaves affecting people. I was just thumbing through old papers here, and by pure luck, I have in front of me a copy of Science News, May 21st, 2011. It's referring to DNA being unzipped by terahertz radiation. Let me read three sentences, and I will mail a copy of this to Ray Graff. What's the mailing address for the station there, Ray?
You can go 318 Central Avenue, Albany, New York, 12206. And do me a favor, make that attention Jim Lavoulis. He's our producer.
Okay, let me get that.
And then we'll pass it along to the scientist.
Tell me the zip again.
12206.
06, okay. Let me read you three sentences here,
right,
and then I'll be done.
Okay.
Annie Yeshiva-Smidjiska of Harvard Medical School and her colleagues have discovered that prolonged exposure to terahertz radiation, comma, a type used in some new airport scanners, comma, can provoke DNA strands to inappropriately unzip. The change can reprogram certain cellular functions and nudge stem cells toward becoming fat cells. A paper describing terahertz effects on DNA now the breathing is talking about the unzipping. That's an earlier part of the article. I didn't read it. DNA breathing appeared in the December 21st, 2010 plus one.
Okay.
I've got.
All right, that's great.
And I think I also read something else about resonance with DNA.
All right.
In an earlier or later article on concern about non-ionizing radiation.
Okay, right. Gerald, let's go to our scientists here.
Sure. I'll take the DNA as a biochemist. DNA regularly zips and unzips. The way that the double strands of DNA stay together are attractions through space, not bonds. We call them hydrogen bonds, which is really unfortunate because they're not bonds. They're attractions, kind of like magnets attracted to each other. They're meant to be non-permanent, that they can come together or come apart, just like magnets. I think the key issues there is prolonged exposure. Nobody's in the TSA scanner for prolonged periods of time, and that we're talking terahertz radiation. So again, not something that you're going to run into on a daily basis.
That's very, very, very short wavelength.
Big exclamation point.
Yeah.
And I'm sure intensity is involved here. So I think what they're looking at is a proof of concept, like how much does it take? But these are not bonds breaking like DNA running into cancer. These are the normal unzipping and zipping of DNA, the way that you would play with a zipper on your coat.
All right. Over quickly to Mark in Deerfield. Mark, you're on.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. The question I had related to hot and cold water that we were talking about earlier. I'm just about to do a renovation on the house, trying to decide if I should stay with copper or go to the new plastic pipes that they have now. And the second part of the question is there, in fact, heat loss for the hot water running through those cold copper pipes in the basement? By the time it gets to my faucet, it probably takes 15 to 30 seconds to get warm at the faucet. It would be reduced or increased? Would it help to have plastic?
You have three scientists nodding on the radio.
All right, they're nodding, so go ahead.
Go.
Yeah, absolutely. The plastic pipes will insulate better than the copper pipes. The water will lose less heat.
And the best thing about plastic pipes is that if the water freezes, the plastic expands rather than breaks.
That's handy.
Say that again. I'm sorry. I'll turn my radio off and take it off. If you're using
PEX, plastic pipes rather than the regular metal ones. The metal ones tend to break if they freeze, and the plastic ones don't. So it's a real benefit.
And the downside is the plastic won't last forever.
Okay.
But the copper will if you don't freeze it.
Yeah.
And the copper's super expensive.
Nowadays.
It's not.
Certainly.
Yep. Yep.
All right, over to Jim and Adams. Jim, you're on.
Yay, Ray.
How you doing?
All right. Thanks for taking the call. Yes, I was wondering if anyone can explain the phenomenon why a duck call will not echo outside.
Why a duck call will not echo outside? Now, this is the
first
I've heard of this.
They had a TV program a while ago. I didn't get to see it, really, about that very topic. I didn't get to see the program.
It seems to be counterintuitive, actually.
Actually, I've heard many ducks.
Like an actual duck? Or
yeah, a duck
like a fake
quack.
Duck call?
When they call outside, there is no echo to their calls.
At my house, the duck echoes yeah, quite
he lives
nicely.
In, believe it or not, he lives in Ecker Hollow. Mm-hmm. So he's in the holler.
Right.
He's got a lake, and he's got ducks.
And they echo?
And they echo.
Are you sure?
They do?
I can tell you they echo for sure.
Okay.
Well, I guess the show was a farce.
Where's the show? What was the show?
It was on television a year or two back or so, I think.
Then it must be true.
I will go outside tonight, and I will sound like a duck and see what
I get. He doesn't have a smartphone. Otherwise, I'd make him tape this so that he can prove it next
time.
Well,
he's got tape recording equipment. I want to hear this on the show next time. Jim, we're going to take your theory as being true until Ed can prove that it's wrong.
Otherwise.
Thanks, Jim. We appreciate the call. All right, here. Let's take one or two more here before we get out. Mark in Fort Plain. Mark.
Yeah, I was wondering how they describe, like, organic, because when it's grown outside and you get the rain that comes from all over the place, got to have all the chemicals and stuff into it. And I would say that still has to absorb into the plants because the plants drink the water. So how can they really call that organic unless it's grown like in an environment that's controlled with filtered water and filtered air so no contaminants can get in there?
Evaporation is very good at purifying water. So unless there's something in the air that's being accumulated in the rainwater as it comes down, rainwater is pretty pure.
Okay.
And the definition of organic is pretty flexible.
It's not man-made additives, really.
Yeah.
Okay.
Because
you can
use, your animal's manure and stuff as a supplement, and it's still organic.
Okay. Thank you. I'll take your word for it. Mark in Saratoga. Mark, you're on.
Yes. Hi. I was very interested earlier in the comment about how water at sort of the molecular level has a natural stickiness to it, but when it aggregates up into something that we directly experience, it takes on a different type of quality. And I'm wondering, across the sciences, this sort of micro to macro aggregation changes.
Okay.
Is there like a concept that sort of unites this idea of how we experience it versus how at the micro level it actually works?
All right, we have 20 seconds to answer this question, so go ahead.
Okay.
Intermolecular forces.
Yeah. And yes, you're absolutely right. Things are different on the micro and macro scale, and it's not clear where that break occurs, and it occurs differently in different kinds of systems.
Well, that's where we will leave it today. And I know, Barb, you wanted to mention that enrollment going on.
Oh, pre-registration at SUNY Cobleskill, if you're fascinated by our hour. This pre-registration starts next month, and the semester starts just after Martin Luther King Day.
Can I sign up?
Yes, you can.
And we'll be teaching geology, astronomy,
water chemistry, biochemistry, general chemistry.
You name it, we got it.
Okay, that'll do. Support comes from Colby Attorney Service, document filing, documented information retrieval, and other services, including legal publishing and corporate record searches, ColbyService.com. Watercolors by Edith, Shutesbury, Massachusetts. Edith Hunsberger, a painter in acrylic and watercolors, specializing in portrait paintings of people and pets from photographs, edith-hunsberger.artistwebsites.com. Vermont Coffee Company, organic coffee in the brown paper bag, now roasted with renewable energy. Vermont Coffee Company, coffee roasted for friends. And HMT at the Spa Little Theater kicks off their 34th season with the musical Young Frankenstein, based on the Mel Brooks film, weekends October 13th through 28th at the Spa Little Theater, Saratoga State Park, homemadetheater.org. Thanks again to Barbara Brabets, Ed Stander, and Jim Pickett for being here. They're the esteemed science panel, and they will be back. Thanks to our esteemed engineer, Zach Malloy, and your phones were answered by Jesse King. And tomorrow on Food Friday, we learn about bacon. This is my kind of show. Tune in tomorrow at 2. Right now, stand by for news.